Well, hold that thought, because we are going to move immediately to government formation, Anya. And I suppose, you know, momentum with independence seems to be the consensus at the moment. If the next government is to be made up of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and another element, that seems to be where the focus lies at the moment. We have Marian Harkin here from the regional group in studio with us. What moves have been afoot today, and what would you regard as significant from what you've been looking at?
Well, as far as the new regional group is concerned, I mean, we came together just purely from the perspective of setting up a technical group. For those who are in the parliament, they'll know what that means. It means you get speaking time. It means you get leaders' questions. It means you get priority questions and all of that, so that you get visibility within the Dáil and that you get priority from the perspective of your numbers, that you can take advantage of that. And that's important, that you're visible, that you can make the case. And nothing further has been decided. But to do that day one or day two, I think, was important because it makes a statement.
Okay. Enya Nivreshlan, how closely is this being watched, and is this regarded as a significant move as far as people who are watching the maths of government formation are concerned?
I think definitely it's a significant move. I understand it is made to be allowed speaking rights and to be allowed to pose questions and so on. But looking at the makeup of that independent group, it is very interesting. You have certain people who have been previously perhaps in ministries of state, such as Sean Canny, Kevin Boxer-Moran. You're looking at people who are maybe gene pool from the parties, such as Gillian Toole there in Meath, who's gene pool Fine Gael, and looking at new faces such as Barry Heenahan coming in. It's also a kind of a, it's quite a good regional spread as well, I suppose, throughout the country to look at people with different constituencies and different issues. Whether this is the group of eight that actually will go in with the government will remain to be seen. It's hard to say if everyone there will take up perhaps a government offer, or will the government take up perhaps an outstretched hand from them, listening to the likes of Barry Heenahan this evening talking about an informal meeting with Micheál Martin, and that it is absolutely in his and his constituents' interest to want to enter government. It's going to be very interesting, but nothing can happen, of course, until these talks progress. And then a Kim Corley has to be elected, first of all, which could be very interesting because we'll see who'll be in the running there. And that could be seen as the first sweetener maybe handed out to members of the Dáil.
Right. Somebody from your own neck of the woods, Pat the Cope Gallagher, said to be interested.
He said to be interested. He was last Kim Corley the last time he was in the Dáil up to 2020. Geographically, it would be interesting. I suppose it's seen as a seat. You're guaranteed a returned seat. Pat the Cope would be 76 years of age. I think he may be one of the eldest, if not the eldest, member of the Dáil at present. Brendan Smith, Cavan Monaghan, also interested, and a man who fought for his seat as well. Michael Moynihan mentioned in Cork, and John McGuinness, Carlo Kilkenny. But now Sean O'Farrell, who was the last Kim Corlin who was returned to the Dáil, it's rumoured that he is interested in putting his hat in the ring again for re-election. But often it is a TD outside of Dublin that gets this role, and it can often be seen as, you know, the first sort of olive branch or the first treat handed out.
But before I go back to the panel, just Micheál Martin's mentioning that he was saying that coalition negotiations would have to reflect the strength of the constituent parties. What's understood to be meant by that? Is that basically... Is it understood to be yes to rotating Taoiseach, but that something would have to be looked at in the balance of cabinet for portfolios outside of that arrangement?
Well, he said that he wants the reflection of Fianna Fáil's majority to be reflected in the cabinet positions, I suppose. But is he going to back down on the rotating Taoiseach, or will Fine Gael back down? There's a lot of talk tonight about parity of esteem and due respect. And I wonder, will Micheál Martin be able to push it far enough to get as many ministries as he can and then perhaps give in on the 3.5 years or 3 years as Taoiseach? It was interesting this evening I heard him mention a government that would run for 4.5 years instead of 5. So maybe he's already thinking of cutting down the time that he'll have.
Maybe he just wants a summer election next time around. That's
well,
and try to avoid November. I think possibly. Ruth Coppinger, I mean, the maths at the moment point clearly towards Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and some independents. It seems unlikely in terms of opposition parties that any are immediately enthusiastic to go in. I mean, how do you view that? Do you view it with trepidation that you will have a government that has parties of the centre and centre-right dominating it for the next 4.5 years? Or do you view it as long-term an opportunity in Irish politics to get to a point that hasn't been there before, where there's a clear left-right split between government and opposition, whatever way that's configured in the future?
I think nobody is looking forward to the prospect of another Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael government with a group of either, you know, maybe right-wing independent TDs, or the Labour Party seemed keen, but whether that's an option for them, particularly with the existence now of the Social Democrats, it would be quite foolish of them, I think, to go in on their own, you know, to prop up such a government. And the reason I say that is because we have seen even though they, you know, they got 20% each and they're boasting that they did quite well, historically they are on the decline compared to where they were, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But also there's so much inequality.
You mean Labour specifically?
Sorry, no, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
Oh, Fianna Fáil, yeah.
Sorry,
okay,
apologies. And I think what we've seen over recent times is the, you know, despite having vast wealth, the unaffordable homes, lack of investment into public services, a neoliberal economic model being followed at every turn. And that looks set to continue. And I think it's very important that we didn't get change through the ballot box, but we have to try and build change from outside. And I would emphasise that that can and has been done before. It was done in relation to the water charges. It was done in relation to repeal, which was a, you know, grassroots movement that came from outside the Dáil, forcing the establishment to concede something it didn't want to concede. So I think that that's posed now, that that's what we have to build is, you know, grassroots movements and organising with communities.
OK, Marion, and by the way, when you talk about Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and centre-right or right-wing independents, do you include Marion Harkin in that description?
Well, I'll let herself identify herself, but I think that would be the soundings. Like,
okay, yeah. How do you think that description matches Marion Harkin?
I was canvassing one night in Boyle, or was it Carrick? I can't remember. No, it obviously wasn't Boyle. It was Carrick and Shannon, and somebody didn't answer the door, but they opened a window upstairs, and they started speaking to me. And I sort of craned my neck up and we had quite a long discussion. I mean, it seemed long to me. I was standing there. And at the end of it all, this person said, I'm concerned that there might be a downturn. So I need to know, where are you on the political spectrum? Are you centre left or centre right? And I knew from the conversation what this person wanted to hear. And I said, well, look, I have to be honest with you. I said, I would think I'm centre, but I'm centre-left more than centre-right. And that was the wrong answer, and I knew that. But I just couldn't say otherwise. Right.
Well, you did sit with the ALDE group in the European Parliament, which is now renewed.
I remember saying to its leader at one time, Guy Verhofstadt, I was the only socialist in that group.
Right.
And he did not argue with me. So if you look at my voting record, you know, sometimes people say, I believe in this, I believe in that. But if you look at people's voting records, you get a sense of who they are and where they come from. And I would see myself as slightly more centre-left than centre-right.
Okay.
And even some of the legislation, the amendments, the stuff I brought through in the European Parliament would reflect that. It's not left-left, but it's certainly centre-left.
OK. Ruth Coppinger, I do want to ask you, you know, there has been talk about looking back and raking over the ashes of the election, maybe there should have been a greater cohesive left-wing effort before this. People Before Profit wrote to Sinn Féin and called for this. But Sinn Féin now, I suppose, criticising Fianna Fáil for ruling out talking to them after the election. I mean, if Sinn Féin is making overtures to Fianna Fáil, how do you view that?
Well, I think, it's very strange for a party. Sinn Féin doesn't identify itself as left. That's why I asked Marion if she wanted to identify herself. I think it's primarily about nationalism.
Well, it views itself as left Republican, is I think how it generally views itself.
I think it sometimes does, but all I'm saying is that it needs to make it very clear, and its supporters need to make clear what way direction it wants to go. Is it willing to, you know, tackle the vested interests, the wealth, etc., in society? I think it would have been definitely helpful if all of those parties, like Labour, the Social Democrats, who obviously got a very big youth vote as well, had ruled out any association with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. It just would have given people a clear alternative, because there's no question, I'm sure everyone found this, there was a real lack of engagement. People did feel it was a done deal.
Although their mandate was stronger than your mandate. I mean, your absolute ruling out of talking to Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael going into this election did you no favours in terms of your seat count, whether that was the reason or not. But on the face of it, parties that were open to talking to all comers did better.
I think it was difficult. We actually did better. Our national share of the vote increased from the last election. But we unfortunately were very unlucky in some of our seats. Like Mick Barry lost out by 40 votes after a constituency being redrawn, two new towns being brought in that he'd know, you know, it was a difficult. And I think the same happened in relation to, you know, a couple of other people. Like we were unlucky with Hazel Norton. So it could have been a return of four, five of us. But unfortunately, it's three. However, it's three strong people, and I think that we now need to discuss. We're going to have a discussion tomorrow among ourselves about how we are going to build up a left alternative in this Dáil and operate.
Okay. And I mean, I noticed, and we'll get on to some of the policy issues, but I noticed in the lead up to the election, I was talking to Richard Boyd Barrett, your party leader, in the lead up to it. And when I asked him if he included Labour in the left group, he said yes, but that hadn't been the position before. There was a kind of a softening of the attitude in People for Profit Solidarity towards the Labour Party after having for years said they wouldn't forgive them for the years they were in power from 2011 to 2016. I mean, how did that change come about, and will it continue into opposition?
Well, obviously, People for Profit and Solidarity were two separate groups, but we, you know, we worked together.
Yeah, I mean,
we,
for the purposes yeah, of, sorry, yeah. leader for the purposes of the Dáil group, yeah.
Yeah, sure. But I'm just saying I'm not privy to every discussion that would have been had in People for Profit. So, but look, I think if Labour and the Social Democrats and Sinn Féin are serious about building a left alternative, you know, I think we need to discuss, well, how does that come about? Is it willing to actually challenge capitalism? Is it willing to, you know, which is the basis of the inequality? Is it willing to tax wealth, the untapped wealth that exists in this society? Because that's what you need to provide public services, to provide public homes. And that they will be the main discussions that we need to have now.
Okay, we'll get into some of the issues now. Anya Nivreshlan, the incoming government, it contested the election on different manifestos. If that government is to be made up of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they'll have to find some working form of that also incorporates whoever they go into government with. But the expectation would be broadly that it would continue from where the last government left off, would it?
It would be broadly, but I would imagine if now is the time for a shake-up, if there's going to be departmental changes, if there's going to be a lot of maybe shuffling on a regional or on a geographical basis, now is the time to do it. Not only because I suppose all the parties have perhaps, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil have lost seats in key areas. Fine Gael have nothing in Donegal. They've been left without a seat in Kerry. They don't have someone very significant like Heather Humphreys in Cavan Monaghan. And they'll have to look at this government makeup in terms of seats on a gender basis as well as on a geographic basis, and people such as Catherine Martin have been lost. There's a Minister for Health going begging, and are you going to reward people for winning seats, such as perhaps Charlie McConlogh, who had a very tough time with his ministry and was probably found it very difficult to win his seat with redress coming in ahead of him, and then people such as Derek O'Leary, who had been given a seat at the beginning of the last government, but due to the Gulf Gate issue, it was taken off him again swiftly. So there could be a full, you know, there could be a very big redraw here.
Derek O'Leary, I think he was proactive in taking it off himself. We're going to look at some of the issues of, I suppose, what was broadly termed across the water, levelling up. Stephen Moffat, you are National Policy Manager with Barnardo's. What is the single best investment that the incoming government could make to tackle the stubborn issue of child poverty?
So I think it's hard to narrow it down to one specific measure. I think what government needs to do is twofold. One, it needs to target more income support on very low-income families. Families who are really struggling, who have been struggling for a long time. The past couple of years have made it even more difficult for them. So that's children living in homes for long periods of time, struggling to access absolute essentials. So that is an absolute must. And at the same time, they need to try and reduce costs around other essentials for those children in those homes. So that means, you know, some work that has been done over the last government, which we certainly, you know, commend around hot school meals, free school books. But they need to go further than that. You know, need to be serious investments in terms of reducing costs and pressures upon parents, particularly those on very low incomes, because the longer children live within those households where they're really struggling to provide their children with essentials, the bigger an impact it has on them and their futures.
And in terms of, you know, some of the other structural issues, like you see areas with multi-generational trauma, which affects education, which affects, you know, social cohesion, which affects so many things. I mean, a government with unprecedented resources, it's not going to see any immediate payoff, obvious payoff that's politically saleable. That, I know this is quite cynical language to use, but I'm just looking at when investments are being made. A long-term commitment to tackle these issues is a kind of a leap of faith for governments. I mean, have we seen it before, and what do we need to see more of?
We've certainly seen some, big picture, longer term investments, you know, from the government, but combined with philanthropy as well. We saw that in, you know, the ABC programs that are dotted around, you know, 12 areas of high disadvantage. You know,
just to explain that a little bit.
So it's, you know, it's 12 areas high disadvantage that was in, you know, programs with a substantial amount of investment put in for community support within areas. You know, areas where there would be high unemployment, high school leaving percentages, you know, real issues around low incomes. So, you know, there was long-term planning around that. Unfortunately, we've seen that, you know, the resources within those areas decline over time. And unfortunately, some of that long-term successes that you would be seeing now, unfortunately, that's begin to dip in some of those areas. I mean, some of the communities that we work in, you know, we're living in a country where there's been an explosion in wealth to some degree, and some people are really seeing the benefits of that. Some of the areas that we work in have gone from very disadvantaged to extremely disadvantaged over the past 5 years. And, you know, the government needs to really take a look and think about, any new government, sorry, I should say, really needs to take a look and think, right, how can we right that ship? Because it's the children living in those communities, that's going to affect their entire lifetimes. Unfortunately, those children are being left behind to a certain degree. So yeah, the government does need to take a long-term plan. It's not something they will see immediate results out of.
And when you say, you know, when you look at the issue of resources, is that because sort of the cost of living issues have gone up, cost of running projects has gone up, and the funding hasn't risen to match that? Or has there been an end of a term of funding and it's just ended and ebbed away?
I think within that specific program, it's, you know, funding has decreased over a certain amount of time. I think across the board, though, what we're seeing is there's both an increase of need amongst families and amongst children within the country. You know, that's, we're seeing higher levels of mental health issues amongst children and young people. We're seeing certainly higher levels of deprivation over the last couple of years, which is quite alarming given the fact that there was cost of living packages and once-off measures. Clearly, they weren't going far enough to, you know, make sure that more children had adequately heated homes. We're seeing more children obviously living in emergency accommodation, poor standards of housing for many children. So I think we're seeing that there has been a decline in terms of some resources alongside an increased need. And what we really need to see across the country is matching supports and services with that increased need. Now, that's not something that's easily done. We're coming from, in some areas, low baseline. But there has to be a long-term plan about how we address this, or you're just going to leave a generation of children behind.
All right. Marion Harkin, there was supposed to have been, we don't have a government rep on the panel tonight, and for clarity, I'm not expecting Marion Harkin to be a government rep. But there was supposed to be a unit set up under the Taoiseach's department to tackle child poverty. I mean, were you aware of any of the actions arising from that initiative, and are there projects outside of, you know, areas of urban deprivation that Stephen was talking about there in your constituency where you'd like to see headway made to tackle issues like this?
Yeah, well, Stephen spoke of targeting income supports, and, you know, a lot of the programmes that government have put in place have been across the board. Everyone benefits. And at one level, that's just not right. At another level, maybe the cost of differentiating between who benefits and who doesn't. And then the people who are marginally below and who are coming to Ruth and to me and to other politicians saying, well, look, the person who's earning just a little bit more is not getting it, but the person who's earning a little bit less, you know, just won't get it. Those are the concerns that you have to worry about when you differentiate, be that you have a cut-off point.
What people call poverty traps.
Yeah, poverty traps. That, you see, it's not just those who are in lower income brackets. It's those who are in lower, what they call middle income, the people who struggle to pay their bills and who have to pay most of their bills because they don't get assistance with it. So it's very difficult to refine that. But that is the job of government. We can't say it's difficult, so we walk away. We have to say it's difficult. So that's the challenge. That's something we have to do.
And if, you know, as I say, you're part of this Eight Strong group, you'll be presenting policy priorities in the areas of, you know, the most disadvantaged communities in the constituency you represent. What would you put on the table as a key issue to tackle that would also, you know, benefit other constituencies?
I think two things: access to services, in particular mental health and disability services. They're absolutely crucial for low-income families, because middle-income and you know, those who are higher income or close to it can somehow sometimes manage to find the money to maybe access private supports, whatever.
Assessments of need.
It costs them. It costs them big time, and we shouldn't, you know, minimise the cost on families.
1,600 quid for an assessment of need.
But because it's your child, you're going to do everything you can. But if you can't, if it's just simply not possible, then you are completely in that poverty trap. So I think access to services around mental health and disability, and also when it comes to homelessness. And I think that requires a sort of a change in how we look at the needs of the communities that we serve, and how we can do that in a reasonable way without, you know, giving advantage to those who have enough already. Okay. And not helping those who really need it. And I think
I just want to go to Ruth Covender on this. You represent a constituency that has a number of areas that would be have high indexes high indices of social deprivation. I mean, in terms of the projects that Stephen Moffat was talking about there, projects that have made progress and that you'd like to see greater support for. I mean, what would you like to see the incoming government, whatever its makeup, what would you like to see them do? What particular projects would you like to see them to target, and what wider measures would you like them to see take?
Yeah, so there are communities where, you know, you may have a lot of traditional social housing where incomes are very low. You have a lot of lone parents, you know, so they have been completely left behind, particularly as the cost of living increased. And as Stephen said, these one-off payments really don't really benefit people in the long term. They need massive investment in those communities, and services, facilities, extra help, re-education, autism classes. It was mentioned about the assessment of needs. That's a very modest price. I'm being told about €3,000 by a lot of parents. That's an absolute scandal. The government is breaking disability legislation every day, and this is a real... If you have a child that has a disability, you pay so much extra, you know, for them, for everything. Speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, all of those. It's
transport.
A huge issue. Transport, yeah. There's actually 1,274 children on two waiting lists in Dublin 15, and some of those waiting lists go up to 7.5 years. And at the root of it all is housing, because housing is a massive cost. So outside of those communities, I also represent lots of high rent areas. I know a family's paying €3,000, working 2-3 jobs to do that. A lot of migrant families as well that have come here and have lived here for 20 years doing vital work in our economy, but not earning a lot of money, and they're really struggling too. So there has to be the use of the wealth that we have to really have a, make a huge impact on those issues. And those waiting lists that we spoke about can't be cleared unless the housing situation, we can't. I went back into teaching. We can't get teachers. We can't get nurses. We can't get therapists. So the CDNT waiting lists are going to persist.
That's the Community Disability yeah. Network teams.
Yeah, because they can't recruit people for them, even if they wanted to. So the government has created this situation by persistently ignoring the housing issue, leaving it in the hands of vulture funds and the private market is not going to work. I'm not confident that this government that's going to be set up will do what's needed, which is a massive investment into public housing that's affordable, that's, you know, accessible for most people.
Okay. They have said in their defence that they've built the highest number of houses since 1975. So that's that is where a government rep to be here. That is what a government rep would say. Stephen Moffat, just looking at Ruth Coppinger and Marion Harkin there, we're talking about poverty of services, you know, material poverty as well. The incoming government, you know, should it meet with people who work in the sector and maybe involve people like yourselves and others who have that up-close expertise of the projects that work to maybe plan the initiatives that would get multi-annual investment if that is what the approach is to be?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they need to get people in the room who've been working in the sector for a long time, who are close to communities. And I think the big thing as well is they need to get the people themselves into the rooms. They need to get parents who've been struggling over the last number of years, parents who may have been out of work for a whole range of different issues, about what would help them, about the supports that they've been missing and what they've been lacking. You know, we've been in a position where we've talked to different governments in the past, where we've sat down with ministers, you know, and we're really welcome to do that. And we bring parents along as much as possible and where it's certainly appropriate. But there, one of the things that we know is that there is programs out there that work. There's projects out there that work. We don't want to reinvent the wheel over this. What we want to see is long-term commitment. And really sort of having, you know, you mentioned that there was the Child Poverty and Wellbeing Unit, and that's, you know, really an excellent step forward. But that's about sort of trying to improve things gradually across departments. What we need to see is a bigger picture. You know, what's the long-term plan to try and lift these communities out of disadvantage? And exactly as you say, to start, you know, by going into communities, talking to organisations that are closest to the ground, chatting to the people living in those communities, and then making roadmaps than what they're going to try and achieve over the length of time of a government. And not just going in and saying, right, let's see if we can open one or two new projects.
All right. Enya Nivreshland, the other issue in terms of trying to achieve equality is regional equality. Areas of the country that mm-hmm. have not enjoyed the economic success of other countries. The government says it's going to invest in energy, infrastructure, water. That's the outgoing government. There'll be a high expectation, as we heard today, that there's an extra 6 billion Apple money in the tank, that there'll be a serious dent made in infrastructural deficits around the country.
Yes, and just listening there to talk of disadvantaged areas and regionally, I'm based here in the Donegal Gaeltacht, and Donegal scored the lowest and most disadvantaged on the Pobl Deprivation Index in terms of things such as housing, employment status and so on. And especially in this county and looking at probably the northwest corridor, that area would be infrastructure, roads infrastructure. It's very well to talk about rail infrastructure, but I suppose in this county people would be looking at the basics of road infrastructure to access services, especially health services, because a lot of people in this area would use the health services in Derry or perhaps in Belfast, because they're closer and they're easier to access more often than going to Galway or going to Dublin and investment in housing, I suppose maybe the redress issue would be one that perhaps could come up and might come up if an independent such as Charles Ward with the Redress Party was to go to the government. And to it's a specific part of probably the housing problem that's been highlighted here in Donegal, but definitely it would be a county and maybe a region that would see itself as maybe more forgotten. I know there's a chunk of South Donegal in Marion's constituency as well, and she would be well aware of issues on the ground here, but it would be an area that would be hoping for some sort of investment, and especially looking towards being part of the Northwest City region with the likes of Strabane and Derry, but that there would be more investment coming southern from a southern government perhaps rather than from Stormont.
In terms of, you know, that kind of infrastructure, presumably people wanting to see employment within the area, particularly an area, you know, like a Gaeltacht area where mm-hmm. people can maintain a community and stabilise, support and grow the language as well.
Definitely, and people have moved away from the traditional industries such as fishing and farming and turbary here, and people want to be able to use their language and their culture and be able to be based at home, be that perhaps in education, in business, working in establishments such as GTECs, and being able to be based regionally rather than going away and moving away from home or emigrating as a lot of people have done and trying to get investment in. And investment sometimes stops in a in a place maybe like Sligo, or it comes to Letterkenny. It doesn't come always to the Gaeltacht areas, but trying to get investment that is suited to the area and that is sustainable as well, not sort of flash in the pan industries that maybe happened 10 or 20 years ago, but something that's more sustainable that can keep people at home working in their own communities. I think it's important to people here.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break because housing has been mentioned by several people. We're going to have a look at maybe some of the infrastructural investment that the next government should prioritise that would facilitate tackling the housing issue.